Today on Against the Grain, racism is finally getting the attention it deserves, including the violence that people of color experience at the hands of the police. But can contemporary racism be understood outside of capitalism? Historian Toure Reid argues against artificially separating race from class, what he terms race reductionism. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. What is the best means to defeat and overcome racism, which has played a fundamental role in shaping U.S. society? Toure Reid argues that while liberals have a long history of separating race from class, that it's only by situating racism squarely within the relations of capitalist society that one can understand and fight it. Reid teaches 20th century U.S. and African American history at Illinois State University. He's the author of Toward Freedom, The Case Against Race Reductionism, which is published by Verso. Toure, let's start with the term from the title of your book. What do you mean by race reductionism, and why do you think it doesn't serve the struggle against racism?
I think the best way to address the meaning of race reductionism is to explore what that frame is reacting to, and that would be the charge of class reductionism. Going back to when Bernie Sanders first announced his plans to pursue the Democratic presidential nomination, activists had frequently charged Sanders as, or characterized Sanders' agenda as a class reductionist agenda that was illustrative of a long history of American liberalism that had supposedly diminished the significance of race and its impact on blacks. And instead, according to this characterization, Sanders and other liberals had tended to treat racism as if it were simply an outgrowth of economic inequality. And what was striking about that characterization of Bernie Sanders is that it was not just a mischaracterization of Sanders' agenda, and I would say the problems with post-war liberalism. It was a mischaracterization of the problems of post-war liberalism by 180 degrees. It was tantamount to a declaration of up is down. And in fact, while it's a given that post-war liberalism and then Clinton-era Democratic politics had failed to redress the sources of material inequality that impacted blacks disproportionately and failed to close the racial wage or wealth gap, The problem with post-war liberalism wasn't a tendency toward class reductionism, which one more time seemed to refer to a tendency among liberals and alleged tendency among liberals to disregard the effects of racism. But actually the problem, rather than being class reductionism, was race reductionism. And what I mean by race reductionism then is a tendency that did in fact characterize post-war liberalism and does characterize contemporary liberalism to treat racism and racial inequality as if racial inequality exists in a world apart from the broader political economic forces that create disparities between the races. So it's a tendency, again, race reductionism is a tendency to treat race and racism as if they're entities that exist on a different plane than economic inequality, abstracting racial inequality from the broader forces in American political economic life.
And do you think that although race reductionism does take different forms, that there's a tendency within it to, by separating race from, say, capitalism and class society, that it makes racism almost eternal, something that isn't embedded in those structural forces and hence in some ways may always be with us?
Oh, absolutely. I think there is a quite transparent tendency to treat race and racism as, if not biological forces, metaphysical forces, as if they are products of nature in some way. And that, of course, is I think profoundly counterproductive because it imbues what is a social construct with qualities that that something reasonably understood as a social construct, which is what race is, that it couldn't have, right? It reifies, that tendency reifies race.
And yet, of course, this hasn't always been this way in terms of the reigning ideas of a time, although this notion, one could point to many, many examples in our era. You argue that if you go back to the 1930s, the 1940s, and look at mainstream African-American civil rights groups, that they had a notion that racial equality could only be achieved through a combination of both anti-discrimination policies, so policies that take racial discrimination seriously, but also social democratic economic policies. Tell us about those politics and their fortunes through mid-century.
Sure. Well, in the 1930s and 40s, Black politics looked really different from how it would look, you know, in the Cold War era. And in fact, I think many activists today would find it in some ways unrecognizable. There are a lot of things that happened in the 1930s and 40s, and the 30s, I think, would be the star of the show for us. But among the major developments that take place in that time period would be the New Deal, right? And obviously the New Deal doesn't come out of nowhere. It's a response to the Great Depression. But in the 30s, we start to witness a push to create a kind of kinder, more equitable form of capitalism. It would be a mistake to characterize the New Dealers as socialists. It's probably a mistake to characterize the New Dealers as social democrats. It's more accurate to describe them as capital P progressives. But what that meant is that many of the policies that they had advocated certainly overlapped with things that we would think of as social democracy, which is why there was, in fact, so much overlap between what Bernie Sanders had advocated in 2016 and 2020 and the New Deal. In fact, it thought that the Bernie Sanders who ran for the Democratic nomination twice was less of a social democrat and more of a New Deal liberal, a New Deal liberal with a quite pronounced labor bent. Another thing that takes place in this time period in the 30s, in a sliver of the academic community, is a pushback against the science known as eugenics and scientific racism, right? So what happens, again, in the 30s and 40s, thanks in part to the rise of Nazism, is that first in the 30s, a stratum of liberal social scientists actually gain some traction in their efforts to push back against scientific racism, of, again, eugenics. And by the 40s, that campaign will mesh with the U.S.'s war effort, and so there's a broader pushback against eugenics. Now, those two things, the rise of the New Deal welfare state in one column and the pushback against eugenics in another, create space for Black activists, as we might think of them today, or Black civic leaders and Black union organizers, to advance a anti-racism agenda that looks quite different from what we would think of as anti-racism, because it was less of an anti-racism agenda per se, and more of a push for a more equitable society. Black activists and civic leaders of the 1930s and through the Second World War had generally presumed, again, I think influenced very clearly by New Deal labor law, that the road to a more racially equitable society required what we again might think of as social democratic policies. It required a right to collective bargaining. It required a right to affordable housing. It required, eventually, some would even coalesce around the notion of a right to national health care. And it should surprise no one, I would say, that Blacks in the 30s and 40s, and this would be Black leaders from organizations like the National Urban League or the NAACP or the National Negro Congress, it should surprise no one that Blacks during the New Deal era embraced a vision of racial equality that presumed that economic equality was essential, if only because the majority of Black Americans were working class in that time period. Blacks were hit disproportionately hard by the New Deal, because of their class positionality, be it in agriculture or as low-skilled workers in industry and commerce. So while unemployment certainly was high for everyone in America during the Depression, it was substantially higher for Blacks. The class cleavages in Black politics were certainly there in the 1930s and 40s. My first book is actually on that. But they were less pronounced in that time period, partly because there was no affirmative action to create a real Black middle class. So there's the spatial divide between Black elites and the Black lower classes was not as great in that era. And that did not lend itself to any kind of shared camaraderie of the sort that I think might, in, at least in my youth, was depicted in Hollywood films and music videos. I think we still find those depictions. But again, that shared, the fact that the class divide was not as pronounced meant that the class divide in terms of politics couldn't have been as pronounced, right? If these Black civic leaders had to address the issues that Black Americans were most invested in. And interestingly enough, in the 30s and 40s, and one more time, this should not surprise, that included being able to get a decent job. So we have that happening in the 30s and 40s. By the 1950s, what will take place is, of course, something that we all know as the Cold War. And the Cold War would have, as I like to put it, a chilling effect on American politics at large, but Black politics as well. And instead of advancing a kind of class understanding of racial inequality, which actually many Black political leaders in the 1930s and 40s understood racism as an outgrowth of economic inequality, in the years immediately following World War II and certainly the 1950s, the more popular understanding of the sources of inequality would coalesce around culturalist constructs and even social psychology. And so instead of viewing racism as an expression of class exploitation, instead of thinking about race as the vocabulary, if you will, of capitalist hierarchies, racism and race were seen by social scientists in the 1950s as not being so much about political economic processes, but instead about sort of tribalist sensibilities, right? And in some instances, even those tribalist sensibilities were thought to be owed to sort of intrinsic ethnic group qualities that would transcend time and space on some level.
And I want to ask you more about that sort of mid-century turn. But before we do, I wonder if we could go back to the New Deal for a moment, because you were saying that the broadly progressive economic policies of the time were of benefit to African Americans. And yet, recent historians have pointed to the New Deal as having a white supremacist layer to it, that various different professions that were predominantly African American were excluded from a lot of the policies and benefits of the New Deal. It's, I guess, contested terrain here, because it is a moment where one can argue about whether broadly distributive policies have a benefit for African Americans and other people oppressed by race.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny, and I really appreciate that question because I think it's useful for listeners to reflect on this. There has been in the last few years, as you allude to, Sasha, an insistence that the New Deal was intrinsically racist and, of course, that Blacks didn't benefit from the New Deal. And while the more sophisticated of the lot will at least concede occasionally that Blacks did benefit somewhat, one of the things that's really quite fascinating about this current discourse is that it proceeds from a couple of erroneous presumptions. One of those erroneous presumptions is if there's been a discovery, a recent discovery, of the racial limits of the New Deal. And of course, what's fascinating about this to me as a historian and as an African-American progressive is that left historians and social scientists had explored for a very long time and in some instances for longer than I have even been alive, the unevenness of the New Deal's benefits. The thing that's interesting about it in the 1990s, though, is those and other left scholars that I mentioned pointed to this problem as a case, as a counter, one, to the assault on affirmative action and AFDC, so on targeted racial programs and means-tested programs. And I want to stress this. In the 1990s, the opponents, those people who pointed out that the New Deal's rewards were spread unevenly, were doing so as part of a defense for targeted programs that were under attack by, of course, Reagan, but also Bill Clinton, right? Those scholars, though, weren't just making a case for the necessity of targeted programs. And they pointed to be clear about this, they pointed to the fact that the white middle class had, in fact, been built on the New Deal and post-war welfare state that African Americans did not benefit from equally. They benefited from, but not equally. Those scholars made that point to highlight the fact that welfare programs, the welfare state, wasn't just indispensable to the establishment of the black middle class by way of affirmative action or mitigating the effects of poverty that were disproportionately felt by black and brown people by way of programs like AFDC. They were making the case that the entire middle class was built on mortgage subsidies, basically, and of course, the National Labor Relations Act. So they made that case again in defense of targeted, racially targeted, and means-tested programs. They were also, though, making a case for a return to the kind of, we will call it as a shorthand, but this isn't really accurate, social democratic, but I'm going to call it public good oriented approach to governance that grew the American middle class, the white middle class in particular, but was also foundational to the modern civil rights movement. The other thing, though, which I think is really what you wanted me to explore, is there's a gross oversimplification in the current discourse about the New Deal's unevenness. There's no disagreement that blacks did not benefit equally from the New Deal. The oversimplification comes in the form that the New Deal is supposedly illustrative. The failure of the New Deal to distribute its rewards evenly across racial lines is supposedly illustrative of the limitations of universal programs. And the problem with that, I think, is that it presumes erroneously that the New Deal actually was illustrative of some vision of socialism or social democracy. The point of the New Deal, which I think was the best moment in American history with regard to efforts on the part of the federal government to make capitalism less harsh, but that's a narrow statement I just made, right? The point of the New Deal was not to create a socialist state, as Professor Glenn Beck might tell us, but instead, the point of the New Deal was to write a listing capitalist economy. And so many of the problems associated with the New Deal's failure to distribute rewards evenly across racial lines were less illustrative of a problem of a kind of left politics, like inherent to a class-oriented progressive agenda, and more illustrative of the problems associated with an approach that was about a policy approach that was fundamentally about shoring up capitalism. So the classic example of the problem of New Deal, of racism embedded in the New Deal, would be the omission, the exclusion of black sharecroppers and domestic workers, or I should say black agricultural and domestic workers from the Social Security Act. And while it's certainly true that the majority of blacks were excluded from the Social Security Act coverage for its first 15 or so years, and were excluded by way of the exemptions for agricultural and domestic workers. About 65% of blacks, I believe, were excluded by way of those exemptions. The majority of workers who were excluded from the Social Security Act by way of those specific exemptions were white. About 74% of the workers who were excluded from the Social Security Act's exemptions for domestic and agricultural workers were white. Blacks were, again, overrepresented among workers who were excluded from the Social Security Act by way of those exemptions. But the fact that the majority of workers who were excluded from the exemptions were white tells you that what's going on is a lot more complicated than a primordial attachment to white racism. And specifically, what it tells you is that the New Deal was fundamentally about writing a listing capitalist economy. The American Farm Bureau, the largest farm lobby of that era, had lobbied against the extension of Social Security benefits to farm laborers. It also lobbied against the extension of Social Security benefits to farm owners, too. And what the American Farm Bureau set out to do fundamentally was to, of course, limit the reach of government into their managerial affairs. They didn't want to pay the tax, of course. They didn't want to just pay the tax for black farmhands. They didn't want to pay the tax for white farmhands. But they also didn't want to pay the tax for the farm owners themselves, right? So they also feared that Social Security would undercut their paternalistic relationships with their farm laborers. So again, the Social Security Act exemption, which is not eternal either, it's problematic. It certainly didn't do right by farm laborers, but nevertheless, at least for 15 or so years, nevertheless, the impetus behind it wasn't simply racism, because if it were, then what do you do with the 74% of those white farm laborers who were exempted? What do you do about the fact that the farm owners themselves didn't want coverage under Social Security because they didn't want to pay the tax, right? You can make a similar point, and I would, about the FHA mortgage exclusion, redlining, right? And redlining policy is, I think, the clearest expression of institutional racism. It's something that not only I've written about as a problematic and racist policy that undercut the long-term life chances of Black Americans, both those homeowners who are excluded, and likewise disadvantaged those homeowners' offspring. Many other left critics have made this point well before my time. But the fact of the matter is that while FHA mortgage policy certainly did not provide Blacks the same access to homeownership as whites, right? The redlining policy certainly was racist. Who wrote the policy? The policy was drafted by the real estate industry, with, of course, input from the banking industry, right? So the real estate and banking industry had already been discriminating against homeowners along racial lines. But because the New Deal was about writing a capitalist economy, writing a listing capitalist economy, naturally New Dealers turned to industry to help draft the laws that would make capitalism more equitable for many and certainly more stable for capital. No question about that. What do those capitalists do when they have the opportunity to draft the laws? They draft the laws so that they would enshrine what had been best business practices into law. No one has denied the fact that the New Deal's benefits were unevenly distributed, right? Leftists have never denied that. In fact, I would say it's one of the things that has always distinguished leftists from liberals in that regard. But what's fascinating about this current sudden interest in this, and it is a sudden interest in a well-known fact, is that it dovetails in this moment with the rights assault on efforts to bolster the status of working class and poor people. It dovetails with the rights assaults in that regard on any calls for a more expansive role for government in bettering the lives of working class and poor people, because the alternative to state action in this model that insists that social democratic or public good oriented pro-capitalism even policies can't do anything to help poor Black people if they're universal. The response that we get is we need more Black businesses. And of course, what is it about entrepreneurs that would give anybody the impression that small business people give a damn about low-wage workers? Where is all this talk about wage theft coming from if small businesses actually give a damn?
Indeed. I'm speaking with historian Ture Reid. He's the author of Toward Freedom, The Case Against Race Reductionism, which is published by Verso. So we were tracing the evolution of what you term race reductionism through the 20th century and into ultimately our time. And I wanted to ask you, we had started to talk about it, about the kind of mid-century turn from the kind of politics you've been describing of one that was embraced by the mainstream of African-American civil rights groups in the 30s and 40s coming out of the New Deal that saw a politics that melded social democratic economic policies with anti-discrimination policies as crucial to addressing the vast racial inequalities. And then you mentioned how there was a sort of retreat with the Cold War, anti-communism, a backlash against the politics of class in basically any form. And then following that, tell us about how liberals turned to a take on racism that pulled race away from class, and lead us through how that evolved from mid-century into the Nixon era and onward in the 70s and 80s.
So in the post-war era, there's a construct known as ethnic pluralism. And if you're not familiar with the term as such, but you have watched original Star Trek, or frankly, any iteration of Star Trek, you are familiar with ethnic pluralism. You just didn't know it. But ethnic pluralism formally rejected race as a biological category, which is great, right? I mean, it's an expression, again, of the post-war sensibilities that dominate, and a positive expression, at least on paper. But while ethnic pluralism formally rejected the notion that race was a biological or real category, it didn't move that far away from biological understandings of group distinctiveness. Technically, ethnic groups are cultural groups rather than biological groups, which ethnic pluralists were always clear on, except what they meant by culture often enough looked a lot like race. So historian Oscar Hanlon would be an example of this, but I bet most of your listeners probably wouldn't know who he was. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, though, who I suspect most of your listeners would know, was also an ethnic pluralist. For ethnic pluralists, ethnic group culture, rather than, I hate to put it this way, rather than political economy, rather than the full landscape of economic opportunities available to people at a given point in time, right, shaped by the status, the laws, in part, of the nation at a given moment, ethnic group culture was the engine of group mobility. So ethnic groups rose and fell, not because of their race, but their cultural attributes. Again, the reason this isn't that far removed from a racial understanding of how the world operates, though, is that what ethnic pluralists seem to mean by culture was not exactly what anthropologists generally mean by culture. Culture is the folks' understanding, sort of intuitive understanding, the folks' intuitive understanding of the world around them, shaped by a common experience. And what that means, then, is that if that common lived experience shapes the culture, if the lived experience changes, the culture moves too with the times. Not in lockstep, because that's not how people work, but over time, the cultural understandings of how the world work change because they cease to explain a changing world, if that makes sense. Well, for ethnic pluralists, they tended to believe that there was still something intrinsic to a Scotsman, right? Since I mentioned original Star Trek, that would make a Scotsman recognizable as a Scotsman in the 23rd or 24th century. I can't remember when Star Trek is set, which is embarrassing because I am a Star Trek fan. But or there's something intrinsic to a Russian that will make a Russian recognizable again 300 years from now as a Russian, or wherever the hell Yahura is supposed to be from. I always thought it was Detroit, but apparently I was wrong about that. So what that isn't, if you think about what culture means, that's not culture, right? I mean, if there's going to be something that transcends time and place across decades and centuries, that's actually a lot more of what race is supposed to mean than culture, right? Because the circumstances have changed. So after a while, there shouldn't be anything recognizable hundreds of years down the line that is, uniquely Scottish or uniquely, Russian or whatever, right? It should change, especially if they're out of their element, like immigrants would be. So for ethnic pluralists, then race is technically a biological, is no longer appropriate, right? Race is garbage, is trash, if you will. As a biological construct, it doesn't exist. Culture is the star of the show, except what they mean by culture looks a lot more like race. And that you see embedded in the thinking of Daniel Patrick Moynihan. So Moynihan's notion of the culture of poverty presumed that the stratum of poor blacks would be untouched by the interventionist state of the 1960s because of the cultural baggage that hobbled them, owed to what we would think of actually as systemic racism, right? Owed to the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and even extant racism. A stratum of poor blacks, perhaps a quarter of poor blacks, lacked the cultural integrity, if you will, to take advantage of the new opportunities that were before them. And what's kind of interesting about this framework is that while whatever Daniel Patrick Moynihan's intent was, the insistence that black poverty was not white poverty, right? And that's what Moynihan's argument is, dovetailed with the Johnson administration's reluctance, but I think fundamentally its refusal to take a more aggressive and a more fruitful anti-poverty, to adopt a more aggressive and more fruitful anti-poverty agenda. And so, because one more time, the Johnson administration actually, in contrast to what many people seem to believe, I think informed by Ta-Nehisi Coates, the Johnson administration was actually committed to the view that Negro poverty was distinct from white poverty, which meant that rather than pursuing the kind of social democratic policies that black labor leaders and left leaders like A. Philip Randolph or Bayard Rustin, but even Martin Luther King Jr. had advocated at the March on Washington in 1963, or by way of the Freedom Budget in the mid-60s, or King's Poor People's Movement, social democratic policies that would have actually, in many ways, paralleled the New Deal by providing jobs, public works to low-wage workers, to disproportionately but not exclusively black. The Johnson administration eschewed those calls, believing that Negro poverty was not like white poverty. So it looked past the impact of deindustrialization and automation, which impacted blacks disproportionately in the 1960s, again, on African Americans, and instead had advocated policies that centered more on job training, which is not a terrible thing, anti-racist policy, which is a good thing, right? Affirmative action comes out of this, anti-discrimination policies is coming out of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Fair housing legislation in 1968, those two things are very good and important, but they also centered their efforts, shaped by the kind of thinking that we find in the work of someone like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, to engage in cultural tutelage for poor blacks. So for them, the sources of black poverty came down to either race in the form of blacks' alleged culture of poverty, poor blacks' alleged culture of poverty, or racism, right? And I think we would know what racism referred to in the form of white prejudice towards blacks.
To Ray Reed, how would you, jumping up to more recent times, how would you characterize the race and class politics of the mainstream of the Democratic Party from Bill Clinton to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris? And how would you also characterize the reaction to those politics from the left? You mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates.
So, from Bill Clinton forward is where we're beginning. I would say that the mainstream of the Democratic Party's take on the relationship between race and class has been pretty reactionary. But it was alarming in the 90s. I was in my 20s during the 1990s, and I spent a lot of time in my 20s pissed off about how things were going. But specifically, one could see if one reflects on the Clinton years, and there were still elements of this, I would say, in Obama's presidency, a Moynihan-like disposition to attribute racial inequality, lingering disparities in the aftermath of the civil rights movement, to poor blacks' alleged cultural pathologies. And just as the Johnson administration had diminished the impact of the disproportionate impact of automation and deindustrialization on blacks, which was exacerbated, I should stress, by the redlining policy, right, which concentrated blacks in inner cities that had once been sites of industrial employment, but by this point, by the 60s and certainly the 90s more so, those communities have lost their industrial base. So the well-paying unionized jobs that had been in central cities that many African Americans had access to in the post-war era were gone, like in one of my home cities, New Haven, Connecticut. And so again, in the 90s, the Democrats like Bill Clinton and Al Gore, I think this is likewise true of Obama with a twist, really disregarded the real significance of that, right, of that movement. Yes, it is absolutely true that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama made passing references to the legacy of deindustrialization and redlining, certainly in the case of President Obama at minimum. But where did they go with that? Right? I mean, if you make the case that blacks have paid a disproportionate price, if you acknowledge that blacks have paid a disproportionate price for deindustrialization, let's say, then why would it make sense to cut the public sector spending? Right? Why would it make sense to not grow the public sector, but instead to pursue policies that cut public housing? Why would it make sense to pursue policies that cut aid to families with dependent children? Oh, wait, and cut's not the right word, that eliminated it, and instead imposed what were kind of draconian workfare policies that subsidized employers and hypothetically trickled down to workfare workers, hypothetically. Why would that make any sense if you're really concerned about the impact of deindustrialization? Or, for that matter, why would it make sense to pursue NAFTA, which had a disproportionately negative effect on black workers because black workers are overrepresented among what's it called unionized factory workers, even though in our popular conscience we insist that unionized factory workers or even construction workers are crusty old racist white men. The reality of the situation is it's a heterogeneous population of workers who worked in industry for sure, and even some of the building trades, though not all. But in the case of both workers in manufacturing and, of course, public sector workers, blacks are overrepresented among such workers. So again, if you really give a damn about deindustrialization and its disproportionate impact on blacks, then why would you pursue NAFTA on top of all of that other stuff that I mentioned? And then adding insult to injury, we get super predators out of Bill Clinton, right? Which becomes the basis not just for the, evisceration of social services that blacks benefited from disproportionately because blacks were overrepresented among the poor. It also becomes the basis for expansion of the draconian police state and an already draconian police state. So yeah, I mean it's definitely true that Bill Clinton, referenced deindustrialization on the campaign trail. He famously said, I think this was in the summer of 1992, so he wasn't president yet, that he carried a copy of sociologist William Julius Wilson's The Truly Disadvantaged with him wherever he went. But the follow-through on Bill Clinton's policies, right? And it's the policies that matter, right? That's your tell. Make clear that he did not give a damn about the disproportionate impact of these political economic movements on African Americans. And of course, race reductionism, as I would call it, a discourse that tries to make sense of inequalities purely through a racial lens that exists apart from political economy, was his escape hatch. And of course, the specific race reductionist framework that he operated with was something called underclass ideology, which is essentially an update of the culture of poverty. It's a culture of poverty by a different name. We saw a version of the same thing, I think, albeit watered down, in the Obama years. And President Obama certainly made a habit of admonishing poor black people whenever he was behind a hot mic. So he also referenced, acknowledged the disproportionate impact of deindustrialization and the like, redlining as well on blacks. But again, what was the follow-through? My brother's keeper and a push for TPP and admonitions against eating Popeyes for breakfast. I don't know about anyone else, but I've eaten Popeyes for breakfast many times. Not in a while, though. It's not heart healthy. But Popeyes for breakfast is delicious. I said it. And despite the fact that I've eaten Popeyes for breakfast, I've never robbed a liquor store. I've never had any baby mama drama, or nor have I sold drugs on a corner. Right? That's not the source of those issues. Poverty, though, which would be owed to the dearth of well-paying jobs for low-skilled workers, would be.
So then someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, the very influential writer of, among many works, Between the World and Me, then reacts to the politics that you've been laying out with Obama, most commonly called post-racialism, although as you indicate, it's not without its racial color. How did he respond to that? Why do you find Ta-Nehisi Coates' response wanting?
So, before I get into my response to the explicit Coates piece, I should say about Obama's post-racialism, and I state this plainly in the book, that post-racialism was a reactionary fantasy. And honestly, I think that a lot of people who hear people like myself making a case for understanding racism, viewing racism through the lens of political economy, imagine that we're making a post-racial argument. I had great difficulty bringing myself to vote for President Obama in 2008 because of his post-racial politics, specifically. And I said to many of my friends at the time, of lots and lots of witnesses who could affirm this, that I was quite dismayed by the zeal among fellow Black Americans for President Obama, if only because, even though I understood where some of it was coming from, but the part that was a major stumbling block for me was that I knew enough Clinton-style Democrats who were excited about President Obama precisely because his post-racial narrative, which is really an up-from-the-underclass narrative, it's an update of Booker T. Washington's bag of tricks. But these Clinton-style liberals, white liberals, were excited about Obama's post-racialism because it was the case for the rightness of Clintonism, right, of cutting social services that benefited disproportionately poor and working class blacks, and for tough on crime policies, right? So it was, part of the backdrop for the racialized war on poor people. But it also, for a lot of Clinton-style Democrats I know, it was also a case against affirmative action. So in 2008, whereas I think people like Ta-Nehisi Coates were actually quite excited about President Obama, I was quite concerned that about the damage that I thought an Obama presidency would do, not the least of which being that if President Obama proved to be simply Black Bill Clinton, I feared that we might find ourselves 4 or 8 years down the line where we actually are right now, thanks to wholesale disillusionment and heightened racial animus, to be honest. But I think for so first, I think it's important to make that point that I just made about post-racialism and what people hear, what I imagine people hear when they hear people like myself make a advance a class-oriented approach to understanding racial inequality. It's quite distinct from post-racialism, even if both the post-racial types and the leftists of the stripe that I am understand race and racism not to be eternal forces of nature, but human contrivances. Second, I want to stress that Obama's post-racialism, his post-racial politics weren't post-racial. They were post-racism is what they were. Obama, as I think you alluded to, drawing from me, though, so I'll take the heat off of you, Sasha, but Obama certainly traded in racial stereotypes about Black people. He traded in racial stereotypes about Black people to make the case that racism wasn't so much the obstacle for blacks anymore, but that race in the form of poor blacks' alleged social pathologies, that was the obstacle, right? Poor black social pathologies were the obstacles, and I would call that race. So again, post-racialism wasn't post-racial, it was post-racism, with an eye toward discouraging blacks to complain about racism, which was extant. It was certainly alive and well in 2008, just as it's alive now. So you never hear anyone like me deny that. Where things would break, I guess, where I would diverge from someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who, you know, I very much appreciate his resonance with the audience that he has sought to connect with. I think that Coates's analysis, though, is a pretty unambiguous kind of black nationalist analysis. In fact, I'd revisited, for some reason, the case for reparations recently, and was reminded of these hints in the case for reparations of his black nationalism, masked, I think, often enough by the kind of purple prose about pain and suffering and the immorality of racism. But there's a line in the case for reparations, which I'll butcher, but it's something to the effect that black nationalists have always been had more of a sober read on racism than integrationists. And when I revisited, I thought, what the hell does it mean to be an integrationist in 2014 when that piece came out, right? I mean, this is a black man who works for The Atlantic, who lived in Paris for a minute, I think. I think he's in Brooklyn. And, you know, I mean, he's living and working around white people left and right. And I think advocates for fair play in the workplace, that's actually, and fair housing legislation, that's all they advocated, right? They weren't advocating having, you know, non-black friends or a social network. It's just having access to places where, you know, to good jobs and good housing. But again, I think part of what's going on with the divide between Coates' analysis, its resonance notwithstanding, is an often unacknowledged, quite conservative subtext to the narrative. And in fact, I don't think it's a subtext, it's a text. And I think that text is actually what resonates with people, because he does proceed from the view, as you would expect someone who has racial nationalist sensibilities to do. He does proceed from the view that racism is just there, right? It just exists. He likewise sometimes, I don't think intentionally, but sometimes trades in quite uncomfortable characterizations of black life. It is no surprise to me that someone like David Brooks, conservative columnist David Brooks, liked Ta-Nehisi Coates' work even before Brooks had become a reparations convert. But it's also interesting what it means to be a reparations convert these days, because it's not reparations. It's not anything reasonably understood as reparations. Coates' black nationalism, the black nationalist lens that he applies to racial inequality is where I think is the fundamental problem with regard to the clarity of his analysis. And a lot of his analysis, a lot of the points that he makes, I think are important. It's great that a generalist audience is finally aware of redlining. Of course, I can tell you, I've been professing, if you will, since 2001, every student I've ever taught, going back to 2001 or probably spring of 2002 when I taught the second half of the AFAM survey, so I was in the 20th century at that point, every student I've ever taught since 2002 learned about redlining. And I didn't discover it, right? Scholars have been talking about redlining since at least the 60s. And even if left scholars were making a very particular point that I referenced, social scientists were discussing the problems of redlining and their consequences for blacks since at least the 1960s. This is not a discovery. It is good, though, that a generalist audience is aware of it. Where Coates takes them, though, is a call for, at best, more of the same. And I don't think many readers realize that where Coates' final analysis takes them is a push for more, targeted programs, means-tested programs and targeted programs that are much more likely to benefit the Black professional managerial class, the Black and Brown professional managerial class, which includes myself. Those policies are much more likely to benefit Black people like Coates and me than they are to benefit the Black low-wage worker, right? The Black or Brown low-wage worker at CVS, you know, your various essential workers are not likely to benefit from growing the ranks of more Black small businesses. You know, entrepreneurs and aspirant entrepreneurs are likely to benefit from that. And maybe some, I don't know, Wall Street, Black Wall Street types and corporate CEOs are likely to benefit from that. But I don't think that Coates's agenda, and I'm not questioning his intentions or his sincerity at all. I think that he has great intentions and is quite sincere. But I think that the narrative that Coates advances and the conclusions that he draws proceed from not sufficiently nuanced understandings of some of the policies and what shaped those policies, more to the point. But also the end result is that the policy prescriptions aren't likely to end Black poverty. I want to say one other thing, that one of the things that I think distinguishes the alleged Black class reductionists like myself or Cedric Johnson or Barbara Jean Fields and a host of others from those who I would cast as race reductionists who are invested in, you know, agendas like reparations. I think we are interested in redressing Black poverty, right? We want to eliminate Black poverty. And we imagine that the only way to eliminate Black poverty is to eliminate poverty for a lot of reasons. Many of them are political. Some of them might be moral. All of them are owed to an understanding that racial inequality is an outgrowth of capitalism, right? Because all inequality in this society is an outgrowth of capitalism. What our concern is that people, you know, like Coates, are advancing an agenda that isn't going to benefit the masses of poor and working class people. That agenda is more likely to benefit well-educated and prosperous Blacks. And I wanted to say that quite plainly, because I think that is the crucial difference between where we're coming from and where many others are.
Historian Toure Reed has been my guest. He teaches 20th century U.S. and African American history at Illinois State University. He's the author of Toward Freedom, The Case Against Race Reductionism, which is published by Verso. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.